The Creative Business Podcast is brought to you by Noosey. Online proposals made simple for creative businesses. Visit noosey.com to learn how your business can start winning more projects today.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Business Podcast, the podcast that aims to help you build a better, more successful creative business. I'm Nathan and I'm here with Marcus. How are you doing, Marcus?
Good, Nathan. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. How's your week been?
It's been busy, 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 busy. How about yours?
Yeah, you could say busy. That might be an understatement. But yeah, it's we got some things going on with Noosey, stuff I don't really want to talk about at the moment. But yeah, we've got a lot on our plate. What about you? You mentioned last week that you were planning for the your training courses. How's that going?
You know, it's going well. We've got them kind of around the country. And so every one of them has a couple of seats. And so now we're in that, you know, that funny place where you've sold enough that you think, oh, maybe this is kind of interesting to some people, but not enough that you have any confidence that as a real strategy, it's going to work. So we're right in that kind of funny place. We're just pushing forward, trying to muster the confidence to get up in the morning and keep working on it.
Just remind us again, what the training courses are for, are they for technical teams? Are they for...
Yeah, it's for technical teams and technical leaders. So folks who have software teams, primarily software teams, and you want to improve the way they work together, the way you lead them, things like that, create a great environment. That's what these two-day workshops help with.
And so how are you getting the word out there at the moment? Like how are people finding out about all this?
You know what? It feels like shouting into the wind, right? I don't know if that rings a bell. But
what does that feel like?
Yeah, you know, you tell your list and then you put it on Twitter 700 times and then people tell you like, why do you only tweet this one thing? And so you try and get smart about it. You try and you read so much where people are looking like they have massive success with these little tricks. So then you wake up in the middle of the night and you think, oh, I need to try some of these tricks or hacks to get this. And you realize at the end of the day, you just need to focus on like presenting a simple message, what the benefits are, and trust that people are adults. There really are no tricks in this, right? You can't trick someone to buying something.
Oh no, of course not. And you wouldn't want to do that because you're not going to get a happy customer there. What about paid acquisition? Is that anything you've tried at all?
Well, we've tried like Facebook ads and LinkedIn ads, but the workshops are a couple of thousand dollars a seat, so most people aren't going to click on a Facebook ad and then say, oh yeah, here, take my $2,000 right now. I think what we are thinking is probably like a paid ad into a webinar where it's like a free webinar that you can join to where you get taught something, one of the topics that we teach in the workshop, and then you can schedule a call to find out how you can like join the workshop. And I don't know, like we're just kind of working on all these funnels. Really, it's miserable work. I'd so much rather be doing almost anything else other than marketing.
Well, if anybody's listening out there who works in marketing and setting up funnels and creating a webinars and all that kind of jazz, I'd love to hear from you. And I'm sure Marcus would as well, because to be honest, I mean, marketing for me as well is the bane of my life. If I could even know what I know now, if I knew it sort of 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, I think we'd be in a different place to where we are now. It's definitely something I would, wow, yeah, marketing. I wish I knew more.
I wish I knew more. Yeah, you know, and that's a great segue into the whole idea of if we were going to do, you know, our agencies again, if we were going to do, you know, whatever it is we're doing now, if we were going to rewind it and do it again, you want to talk about how we might do things differently?
Would this be depressing or will this be uplifting?
It might be. This might be the saddest episode we've ever done.
Maybe it'll help someone. Maybe it'll help someone, as they say in other podcasts, to help you avoid making the same mistakes that we made. So.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe our lives are simply to act as a warning to others, Nathan. I don't know.
I hope it's not that bad. All right, then. So let's look at it then. So, you know, both you and I struggle with marketing, like knowing what we know now. I mean, for example, going back. So when did you start the Creo agency?
2007. So it's been 10 years now. Because, mm-hmm. Well, a little more than 10 years.
And do you think marketing in itself has changed since you guys first opened the doors?
Boy, that's a good question. If it has, like, I bet people who are great marketers, who really understand this stuff and who see results, probably say, oh yeah, the face of marketing has changed. The way people use social media, the way people use video, the way people like email marketing, I bet they would say it's changed dramatically. In the same way as, I guess I could ask you, like, when did you start Nusi?
Well, Nusi started originally, sort of concept 2013,
yeah.
But it wasn't sort of launched as it is now until 2014. I wouldn't say that the marketing has changed that much, as in the options available since then. But if I was to go back further to when I began freelancing as a freelance designer, I would say, poof, it's changed no end, or at least I think the way I approached it has changed. Because when I was a freelance designer, when I very, very first started, which was in 2005, I believe, I was working locally, and you guys were as well to a certain degree with the agency, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We worked with local clients. In fact, that was our original dream, was make our little town look good on the internet.
Right. Okay. And I'm sure that was an awesome dream at the time, but like looking back now, and especially for me, I can see that nothing that I did back then bears any relevance to the kind of marketing I do now, like none whatsoever. I mean, I literally went door to door back in 2005. When I started freelance designing, my niche, I didn't know anything about niches back then, but I was an English speaker in Madrid, you know, a foreign English speaker in Madrid, Spain. So I decided that I was going to target the Irish bars and go door to door around all the Irish bars in Madrid. You know, there's a fair few of those, you know, and hand out flyers with, you know, this is Nathan, I'm a freelance designer and this is what I can do. And it literally was almost like the door to door salesman approach. Obviously, it's not going to help me sort of an awful lot now with Nusi. So I think in that respect, it's changed a ton.
You know, it's funny because I sort of, the hair on my arm stood up when you talked about that, because I also went door to door, if you can believe it, in our little town. Like, we live in a town of 17,000 people out in rural Oregon. There's far more cows than there are people. And we have like the street, it's called Main Street, runs through the center of downtown.
Classic.
And when we started our company, I thought, I got my first pack of business cards, and I thought they were so expensive. I think I paid $99 for 500. Oh, but I was poor, so I was like, that was, really convinced my wife. And I said, I'm not going to put these to waste. I went into every shop on Main Street, and all of these are locally owned little mom and pop shops. And I would just walk in, and it just makes my stomach hurt. And I would just try and convince someone to buy something, right? Like by telling them how bad their website was, or, you know, in 2007, it was like, oh, you know what? Like, you know, the internet's really popular. And do you have a website? Like,
it's so, are you still so using terrible tables for your layout?
Right. And of course, your jeweler doesn't, you know,
have a website.
The local jeweler and the local baker, they don't know if they're using, you know, you ask them, are you using tables? And they're like, well, yeah, it's a restaurant. We've got lots of tables. Yeah. And one guy actually threw me out of his store. He said, why should I talk to you? My last web designer screwed me. Why should I talk? You're all the same. Get out.
Oh, wow.
And I went away feeling very sad, like maybe I joined a very terrible industry or something.
I actually had a similar comment, although he didn't throw me out because it was online. But he said it was funny actually, because he owned some kind of automotive business, and he said that web designers were worse than used car salesmen.
Yeah. Well, I suppose at least my opinion now is these folks are probably right in a lot of ways.
Probably are, yeah.
But you know, that maybe someday we should do a show about working in an industry that has such a terrible reputation. But not today.
It's true. It does. Yeah, and we should do. Yeah, those were our roots. That's how we got started, and it's a far cry from where we are today. So if we could go back, if we could do it differently, how do you think you might start Creo, you know, in this case for you guys? How do you think you might have got that off the ground, knowing what you know now?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is not about marketing. Is that okay?
Yeah, no.
Can we move
just
around
the whole
topics?
Thing? Like, okay. How would you have done it differently now, knowing what you know now?
Yeah, I started it with a friend of mine, and we knew each other pretty well. We had worked together at the same big enterprise, and I would definitely start it with someone. So that part was good. But about a year in, we were both engineers, software engineers, and we felt like we needed a designer, and we didn't have a lot of money. And so we thought to ourselves, well, why not just bring on a partner as a designer? And then that person will work for free, right? What a great idea. Because we're working for free. There's virtually no money. And we found someone. We didn't know him.
That's what partners are for, right?
Right. We did a little project and we kind of tricked him into becoming, not really, but he became a partner. And it turned out that that was a really terrible choice. Not because he was necessarily a really terrible partner, but because in the long run, him and I did not get along at all. And I have to own the majority of that problem. But in hindsight, I got confused about what we really needed. I knew we needed design work, but I should have realized that a partnership is much more like a marriage than I ever thought it was. And the commitment you have with that other person is really unique. And because myself and this other new partner didn't get along, it caused years of internal strife and stress and politics. It just made everybody's life bad. And in the end, it really tore the whole company apart.
But you actually didn't get on any kind of personal level. So there was no sort of, not even a decent business relationship there.
Well, we didn't know each other. And so it started, and in some ways I thought, well, this is going to be good because we'll be professional. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it was almost like founder dating, I've heard, like where you go find someone who has a resume that looks like what you need. And you say, will you be my co-founder? And they say, oh yeah, I want the same thing. And believe me, at the first year, things were pretty good. But like any relationship, when times get tight, when stress is high, if you don't have a real commitment to that other person, a real relationship to work from, it can be really challenging to weather the tough times and you'll end up turning on each other. And that's kind of what happened. And in the course of the 7 years we ran it, I'm glad he was there. We learned a lot, but you know, in the end, my relationship and his relationship just became so bad that we decided we didn't want to work together anymore. And that's what caused the company to fold. The partners just said, well, we're done working together. So that would probably be the first thing I would realize was I should have just gotten an employee or a contract designer when I really needed.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah.
That went deep real fast.
Yeah. The partners thing is tricky. There's no getting around that, is there? Especially, and obviously I was in a similar situation with Michael in that we didn't know each other either. So you either get lucky or you work at it really hard or you have a really bad time. I think one of the three or all of the three, maybe, I'm not sure. So.
Yeah. And I remember when you and Michael first met, like you guys had a great like skills match, but there were a few, I remember in the early days, I happened to be privileged to talk with both of you together and like just trying to get some of the expectations set. Sometimes that's tough.
Completely.
Right?
Yeah, completely. And I think that's part of the problem is what you said with regards to that sort of startup founder dating kind of thing. Michael and I, we'd worked on one project together very briefly. And then, you know, as we've said in previous episodes, he came on board as a co-founder. But like you said, you know, if you don't know somebody, you get to know each other on the job, like literally on the job. So you don't know what the other person expects. They don't really know what you're expecting and what you're hoping. And bringing those two groups, those two sets of expectations together can indeed be tricky. And I think the first year that we were together, it was a challenge, I think, for both of us. You know, without a doubt, it was a challenge. And thankfully, we were able to move past that. And I think in large thanks to the fact that I've been able to sort of relax on what I expect and what I think can be done in a given space of time. So, yeah, I think that found this thing is incredibly, incredibly difficult. But I mean, going past the choosing your partners, what else do you think you would like to have done differently? And maybe not even on the sort of the Creo itself, agency, I mean, like as a whole creative working business thing, is there any other roads you perhaps might have liked to have gone down or gone down sooner? Or,
well, you know, I think, and we talk about this so often, it seems like people are always talking about find your niche and positioning. And this actually ties in with the partners. We spent a lot of time as three people trying to figure out what our niche was, what our positioning, what our market, what our focus, what we were going to be great at. And the fact that it was three heads trying to make a decision that everyone was completely excited about really almost made it impossible. I think we could have done it had it been two, but in the long run, I wish we would have been able to do is all three of us choose to go wholeheartedly towards a particular segment of people, like a position, a mm-hmm. niche, right? That we would have chosen startups or enterprises or timber companies or bartenders, or I don't know, it doesn't even matter who you, in a lot of ways, right? Find someone who you've served successfully and focus all your energy. But we would have the problem of about every 3 months, if the current idea of who we should serve wasn't panning out, we would revisit the discussion again. And so we weren't really committed to serving an audience to where we could really deeply understand and care about that audience. We just would look at our own progress and say, well, you know, it turns out motorcycle companies aren't buying right now. So, you know, I guess that didn't work out. We should pivot and try and, you know, sell to mm-hmm. flooring companies or, you know, Internet of Things.
I think one positive thing about that is,
whatever,
is that when you do start as a generalist, and exactly the same as I did, I pretty much, similar to most other freelancers, consultants, and sort of first-time studios and agencies, is that they will, you know, literally work for anyone who will pay the bills, you know? And,
that's right.
And that's fantastic. But I think one of the positive things about that is that, you know, while you are generalizing, and I would never recommend that somebody specialize right from the beginning because you've got no idea what you're good at, but is that you do learn a series of skills that can be transferred from one area to another. Like, for example, you said, as did I, that when we first started, our marketing was literally door-to-door sales. You know, I know you're a pretty shy guy as well, so I can guarantee that that was an absolute nightmare for you, as it was for me. It was horrible,
it
horrendous.
It was.
But all these little things that we did, I think back then, maybe the phrase help us to be an all-rounder is perhaps not the right phrase, but it certainly, with me at least, gave me a foot in each area. So, okay, I'm not a great marketer. You know, I'm not a great, well, I don't code anything anymore. I used to, you know, I'm not great on social media, but I was able to actually, because I had no choice, I had to do all of those things back then. So at least now I have an idea. I mean, yeah, I wish I was an expert in a few more of these things now, but I think those early days of being an all-rounder, being a generalist, I think can really help for that moment when you do move forward to, you know, to finding that niche and to specializing and to knuckling down in a certain area.
That is true. And it is easy to look back and say, well, the failures I had, those were big mistakes and there was a lot of time wasted. But the experiences I had, whether it was door to door or doing all kinds of different websites, even if they weren't great, and becoming an all-rounder really changes you. It really gives you some different perspectives, and that really kind of shapes who you become. So it's hard for me to be too hard on my past self, right? To say that, well, you made a lot of screwy mistakes because they helped me to learn. Now I'm going to turn this around, Nathan. How about you? What would you do differently if you were going to do it all over?
I would stop worrying about the future so much. I was always a real worrier as a freelance designer, more so in the early days, but even towards the end as well. I was always concerned about the future of web design, as in there wasn't one. I had no real clear idea of how that was going to change and how the future version of a web designer was going to mean I was obsolete, but it was very much there and it was always a concern. And it was part of the reason, or one of the reasons that I was intrigued by the idea of products and services. But I think looking back, I wish that intrigue and interest had come earlier on. I wish I'd made that switch earlier. And again, like you say, looking back, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. You can only do what you do and you can only done what you've done. But I really wish that I'd perhaps discovered certain books or certain people earlier to allow me to at least have played around in that area. You know, when you read about these sort of inspiring entrepreneurs, and of course they were being entrepreneurs, you know, before the word was even, it was even a catchphrase, you know, because it was just in their nature.
Right.
And I think it has always been in my nature to sort of to try and build things and create things, but I don't think I was really aware of what it was. Like my daughter now, for example, my partner, she keeps saying, "Oh, Leonor, she's such a little entrepreneur. She's 8 years old, and every opportunity she has, she's trying to make something to sell to her friends, or you know, to raise money for her gymnastics club, and you know, and she absolutely loves it and thrives in it. But of course, she has no idea what she's doing. She's just it's inbuilt, you know." Yeah, I wish I'd discovered the world of product and product design earlier, because I think it would have allowed me to grow earlier within that space and to discover maybe things that took me a lot longer to discover, you know, because I came via books, you know, via articles. Obviously, you know, Tim Ferriss was a big part in that with the what was the name of the huge hit, the four hour work week.
What a great idea, huh?
to be honest, that probably was the beginning of it all for me. I read that and I was just like, really? I don't have to do this for the rest of my life. I think looking back, I would love to have made the move earlier into products, because it takes, you know, unless you do have one of those huge success stories, then the learning process can be, you know, it can until you actually have something that's good enough to support you and your family or your partner's family, it takes a long, long time, you know? So as I said, I started designing in 2005, we're 2018 now. So it's only over the last year or so that Michael and myself have actually been able to live full time off of Nusi. And that's, you know, that's a fair chunk of time. While I'm in the moment, I mean, looking back in 10 years, 20 years time, it'll seem like the conversation we have now, it'll be completely irrelevant and the blink of an eye. But yeah, I wish I'd been able to delve into that sooner and start specializing sooner as well.
Interesting.
Just to add that.
Sure. You know, I'm curious, did you find in the early days that you spent a lot of time trying to find, like, there's so much writing about entrepreneurs and startups and consultancies and services and products. And right. Did you ever feel like you, because I remember this feeling of like you would read everything you could, and it takes a tremendous amount of time. And sometimes it's good reading, like it inspires you, but sometimes it's reading that kind of makes you go from, I'm trying to think about how to describe it, but it almost like whipsaws you. Like, one day you think products are the thing you should focus on, and so you read a lot of it, and the next morning you get up and there's an article on Hacker News or Reddit or so, oh, you know, services are where the money's at. Oh, okay. And so you do this, all this switching, trying to find like the perfect thing for you because someone else is writing about how great it was for them. I don't know.
It's similar to what you mentioned before about the hacks and tips and tricks that, you know, everyone recommends, and this is going to boost your business, and this is going to, you know, I don't know, maybe we're just not very good at this, but it's obviously working for some people, but many of these hacks and tips and tips that I've read about just simply haven't worked for me on pretty much any level. So yeah, that whole thing of, this is, you know, I tried this awesome technique and it gained us, you know, 2,500 new customers in a week. And yeah, it's so easy to get distracted by this post, that post, and the next post. And I think we spoke about it when we did the conversation with Michael as well. These inspirational stories and posts and conversations, you need to know their place, I think, in your world. And for the longest time, I didn't. You know, I did get distracted by every single post I read, and I'd probably go off to Michael and say, "Oh, we got to try this, and we got to try that," and we probably did. And you know, like I said, the 99.9% of them didn't really move the needle at all. So my solution to that is not to read anymore. I don't read any anymore.
That's my solution too. I really am picky about. I don't read anything that promises a shortcut, essentially.
Totally. I mean, I don't read blogs anymore. I don't, unless it comes via a personal recommendation. Unless somebody says to me, "Nathan, read this," I'm not even going to open the blog. Chances are, I still read a lot of books. I go in and out of phases of business books and obviously sort of fictional books. But with regard, I just don't do it anymore, because it took me the longest time, but you just learn to realize that there's so much noise when it comes to, you know, build a better business, you know, do this, do that, get growth from this, get growth from that. And it's tough because, you know, we are all trying to offer that same advice as well. We are trying to improve people's businesses, you know, through a more sort of user-friendly proposal solution, whereas you're obviously there trying to teach technical teams as well. It becomes so easy after a certain point in your career to just block all that stuff out. Like you said, if you see something that promises a result, then it just disappears from your line of sight. It's tough.
Yeah, I think I used to, I think I called it thrashing at one point, this idea of always looking for the shortcut, the quick win. I was willing to do the work, but I could not stay focused, you know, in a lot of ways on one thing for long enough. I'm sure that everybody who writes an article about how a certain kind of social media post boosts their followers by 1,000,000%, or a certain kind of coffee meeting gets them clients every time, I'm certain those things work. But what is so often, I think, missing is that the people who are writing those things are trying to be helpful, but they're probably devaluing the 5 years that there were that went before for them, where they actually learned how to do it well. And they're trying to like boil it down like 10 tips to close the sale right, you know, in your first meeting. Well, I'm sure they can do that because they've spent 5 years really failing and then deciding to really learn. And it's like 1,000,000 subtleties to it that you just can't write in a blog post. So it gets boiled down into 10 tips. And then you see the byline where it's like, this person has a $100 million a year business or whatever it is. And you're impressed. So you think, well, that's what
completely.
I should do. And it doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to, shocking, you remember when the whole, right, pop-up, modal pop-up thing was so big and everybody swore by it and there were articles, right, all over the web. How I increased my newsletter signups, you know, by 1,000% in a month and blah, blah, blah. And obviously there's always the lackluster effect of any new sort of fad. You know, people get so used to it that it loses its effect. But I think as well, it's exactly what you're saying. People don't see everything that went behind that. So you could see one of these modal pop-ups, sign up for it, perhaps with the promise of a free chapter of a book, which was obviously another huge one as well. But
right,
probably behind that was an absolutely awesome sequence of emails that did a really good job of selling them on whatever it was, the book, or staying on the newsletter list because of, you know, whatever was promised. Whereas, you know, you and I could go out there, or somebody else could go out there, use the exact same modal, log them into a newsletter list and say, hey, thanks for joining my list. Not sending them anything again for a month, you know, because we're stupid. And then the next email they get saying, right, who the heck is this? And unsubscribe. There's so much behind it always that these are the things you don't see in those awe-inspiring articles, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, let me ask you another topic, because this was an area where I had some problems. Like, I've had a bad time the first few years, and this was the topic of money and taxes and savings and like cash flow. I don't know if this rings a bell, but for me, I thought that owning your own business would, because you're charging like $60 an hour, and it's like, that is so much money. That's more money than I'd ever seen. I thought, look, I'm going to have a lot of other problems, but money problems I won't have anymore. Turns out that was the opposite of what actually happened. Money was tough. Money management, completely, all that stuff. How about you?
Completely.
What was your experience around that?
It took me, it's still something I struggle with, but it took me the longest time to realize that not all that money that came into my account was mine. You know, the government owns, you know, 20, 21%, 25%, depending on, you know, whatever. So that has to go straight out the door to another bank account to be saved for, in my case, it was a 3-monthly tax return, and then the yearly, et cetera. And I was always literally from hand to mouth. So if I was having a particularly bad month, then I'd always dive into the business account, take the money from there to pay the bills, and then have to play catch up again the next month. And then by the time the tax season came round, I was probably well out. and had to suddenly find or, you know, borrow from Nuria or whatever. It was always a mess. And I really hope that a lot of new freelancers and business owners learn that lesson a lot quicker than I did, because it's a horrible situation to be in. As you said, you know, all of a sudden you're making more per hour or per week than you'd ever made before. And I mean, previously I was a barman. I'd only worked in bars and restaurants, you know, where I was earning in Spain, I think it was like 8 euros an hour I was making as a barman back in 2003, 2004. And probably most people can agree that's not an awesome hourly rate wage. So when I came a freelancer, what did I do? I did what everyone did. I just doubled that. Hey, look, I'm making twice as much already. And yeah, terrible, terrible way to think and to work. But effectively, yeah, you just, all that tax and all everything else that's involved. I mean, I only had a conversation with Nuria last week where I can't remember what we must have been doing the monthly bills. And I said something along the lines of, we were joking about money. And I said, well, I earn way more than you now. And she has a great job. She's a lawyer. So, and she's like, no.
Oh,
you
golly.
Earn more than me before the tax man gets hold. And she was like, you know, everything I get in my bank, right. That's mine. You know, I earn a wage, I earn a salary, that's mine. You earn more money before the tax man gets a hold of it. And I was like, damn, you know, she's completely right. So it's tricky. Yeah. And it's still a problem for me. It still is.
Oh, it's rough. I know the first year our company did okay. I think like literally I was thinking back the other day, the first year I had my company, we did $5,000 in revenue for the whole year. Which is pretty small. But we also had full-time jobs, so we were doing it part-time. And the second year, I think we did 20,000. So now, okay, now we're getting somewhere. And the third year, I think we did like 60,000. Like, oh, okay. And by then, there were three partners, not two. And we had quit our jobs. But I remember the last year before we shut down, the day we decided to shut down, the partners decided Well, earlier on, I had really struggled with making my own tax payments. So I had experienced the surprise when your accountant says, okay, your tax bill for this year is $25,000 and you've paid $3,000. Like, what are you going to do about the difference?
Time to sell the car.
Yeah, very early on was like, oh no. And so I had to work through that and get out of that mess. And that was very inspiring to make the next year less difficult, although turns out then I still owed like 10,000. Okay, so now I still have some work to do. But the last year we were open, when we shut down the business, we called our CPA and he said, well, on paper, you guys had a great year. Like, it looks like you've got a $240,000 profit. And the three partners looked at each other and went, what do you mean? We don't have that money. And he said, well, you're going to have to pay taxes. Each of you have to pay taxes on this money. And like, that's a lot of money for three partners to split, dear. You know, the tax liability for. And we hadn't managed it very well. Actually, since I've been a solo practitioner, I've become really rigorous. A lot of people do quarterly taxes or maybe even annual. I have made myself an employee and I take my taxes out every month because I am so afraid of getting behind. Mm-hmm. So I actually pay myself like a salary. There's like all this withholding. But that was something that when I started 10 years ago, I would have said, that's ridiculous. Like, don't do that. But I wish I would have taken money and taxes a lot more seriously 10 years ago. I'm just now feel like I'm starting to get a little bit better at it.
That's awesome. I mean, for example, the business account you have for yourself now, is that a closed, uh-huh. Is that a closed account, as in you can't withdraw money before a certain period of time, or do you have open access to it? Because that was my problem, was that I could put my accounting tax, I could put my tax money away, but because I had open access to it, if I needed it to come back, I would just transfer that money straight back again. And then that was where the trouble came.
No, it is an open account. I actually have like 5 accounts. And so I play this game because checking accounts are free at my bank. So I was like, great, give me 5 of them. I want one, you know, and only one of them has a check or like a card that's attached to it. So the other ones are essentially just buckets to put money. But when I say like I do my taxes I pay my tax liability every month, I run a payroll and it immediately just withdraws that month's tax payment, boom. And then the government takes it. So at the end of the year, like last year, I think they actually owed me $1,000.
Oh, that's fantastic. We don't have the option in Spain. You can't do it.
Oh, you can't?
As a business, you can, but as a freelancer, you can't. So because we were just looking at this actually. So for a freelancer, it's impossible. You can't do it. For me, that would be perfect. But as a business, you can, but, and this is wonderful, wonderful Spain, you have to run your invoices, receipts, and everything every 4 days.
Every
4 days, they need to be accounted for to the government.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so there's all kinds of different rules.
So they introduced this last year, and they have had, wow, they've had so much trouble, obviously, because it's an incredible, it's a ludicrous rule. Yeah, so every 4 days. And a huge burden for everyone, a huge burden for the companies, a huge burden for the government. I have no idea why they've done it that way. So yeah, so it's almost an impossibility here. So, but that sounds fantastic, certainly for freelancers and small companies. Sounds like a really great way to go. I'm not sure if it's the same in the UK or anything, but I'm sure they're well ahead of Spain there.
Yeah, I don't know. I just know, this is the other thing that I did when I became a solo practitioner, and I wish we would have done early. We were what's called a partnership LLC, that's when I had Creo. But when I became my own thing, I actually turned it into an S corporation, which is a slightly different business entity. But it's a little bit more expensive to form, and the tax and filing obligations are a little bit different. But for example, one of the things it allowed me to do was set up my company could sponsor my health insurance and my retirement. So I could set up a pre-tax, what we call over here, a 401k, which is just an account that I can dump a lot of money into every year because I own the business and I'm an employee of the business, which is perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. And so I get to put a lot of money away before taxes. And while it might sound silly, if you don't have money, why would you think about saving it? But if you don't have money, that's exactly what you should be thinking about, is how can I save a little of what I have for the future? And I'm 47 years old, so I don't want to do this forever. Retirement planning was one of these things that I wish I would have done a lot earlier. But, you know, now I'm working at it, you know, very diligently.
Yeah, funny what you start to think about, isn't it, once you hit 40?
It is. How about this? You know, I used to think, this is an area that I'm curious if maybe you found the same thing. One of the things I used to think when I would meet, like when I started my business, was my job was to find the best clients. And like the best clients would be clients who were nice to me, who had money to spend, who would like my ideas, who would let me do what, you know, take me seriously, treat me like a professional. I had this impression that my job was to search through all the people like I met and try and identify the good clients and focus on doing great work for the right people. And over time, I've realized that I actually turned a lot of great clients into terrible clients by the way I acted towards them. But I didn't realize it at the time. Does that make any sense?
It makes sense, yeah. How did you do that?
Well, for example, I'm trying to think of some examples, but when a client would give me feedback on something and I would get defensive.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Or I would just not reply for a week.
really? Okay. Way to go.
You know, or when the client would ask for a discount and I would immediately grant it as though I had no self-respect at all, right?
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I think I've sort of become a fan of the idea that you teach people how to treat you. And so, but I really taught people early on to treat me like a worker, to not treat me like a thinker. and that I was pretty desperate for it. That came through, I think, in every sales conversation and in all the people who worked with us. Like, I'll do whatever you want. I'll even wash your car for this hourly rate. Like, we'll do whatever. And it's just such a sad approach, but people can't help almost but to almost take advantage of you. And then you look back and say, well, if I didn't have such jerks for clients, then like I could really make this business into something great. And you're not taking any responsibility for, you know, the relationships that you had a part in creating.
Yeah. I remember going through the transition, and it stands out, the transition. But it stands out quite clearly. I can still remember, and I can remember the client that it happened with, where I tried to go from being the freelance technician to the freelance consultant. And we had a really good relationship until we didn't. And
that's a good phrase.
it actually went on for a good while as well until it didn't. But I remember desperately trying to be that consultant and pushing them towards allowing me to help them with their business as opposed to just designing. And to be honest, I don't think they got it. I was obviously doing a really bad job, or they'd bought into something different than what I thought I was selling. I don't remember now, but they obviously found me via my then portfolio, and contact had been made. But because I was in the process of sort of changing into something better, I think something got lost in the translation. And again, similar to yourself, I did a really bad job. And like, we did actually get on really well. And this client was actually where I learned the huge value of regular communication, Skype meetings, and presenting the work on a regular basis. And that helped. That, you know, it actually changed the way I did business. But I remember really struggling there as well to establish the value I wanted to bring to the relationship as opposed to what they were looking to get out of the relationship. And I think it's difficult, you know, because so many people want to move away from being a designer, being a developer, being, you know, we keep talking about niches all the time, but sometimes it's almost not even the right word, is it? Because you want, all right, so I'm a designer, but I want to help businesses grow in whatever format that might be. So my niche, am I no longer a designer? So therefore my niche has grown bigger. My target niche is still the same. You know, it's companies that want to grow, and perhaps it's SaaS companies that have initial funding or whatever. But selling yourself as that end product as opposed to part of your product is really, really hard, I think. And I wish I'd worked harder at earlier on. Does that make any sense at all?
Oh, it does. It does. And I think that it's double hard when, because I remember a couple of times I wanted to reframe my value for the client. And we were like their, you know, web programmers. And I remember thinking, I really want to be more of their, you know, their revenue consultant or somebody who looks at their overhead or streamlines other parts of their business. And when I'd have those conversations, oftentimes they'd look at me really strangely, like, well, I don't know why we're talking. You're a web programmer, and now you're asking me how our accounting system interfaces with point of sale system. I'll tell you, but I don't see the point in telling you. What I realized at some point was, it's one thing to approach a new client and say, you know, we're here to help you optimize the technology in your business, right? And part of that is web programming. Or maybe in your case, we're here to help you grow your revenue. And part of that is done through design. That is one kind of value proposition, but it's a whole other thing to try and change an existing relationship where somebody looks at you as like, this is what you do. And it's almost like if your auto mechanic wanted to give you marriage advice, right? You might say, well, like, thank you. That's a great piece of advice, but who are you to tell me that? Why are you telling me this, right? It just feels really awkward. So I found it.
I mean, if you'd seen the sign on the door before you went in saying automotive, right, and marriage counseling, then you probably would have had a better idea than rather just saying automotive.
Exactly.
Taking your car in.
Exactly. And if your automotive mechanic asks you, you know, if you're a guy, he says, well, when's the last time you bought flowers for your spouse or whatever? you know, that might seem a little pushy, a little nosy. In the same way, I think some of my clients felt like I was being nosy, almost looking for other work. And they sort of would hold me at arm's length and go, well, you know, I just want you to do the work I've already asked you to do faster and better and more consistently. Like, don't ask to see other parts of my business until you get your part. Well, probably ever, frankly.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to pivot with an existing client, much easier with a brand new client to be the automotive and marriage counselor, but to someone who's never been to your shop before.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Make sure that potential client knows what you're trying to do before they get there.
So many things we would have done differently. I bet we could have gone on for another couple of hours. Maybe someday we should actually hold a conference called Regret Conf, right? Where people just talk about all the things they do differently. But for today, I think that we're probably rounding out this episode, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure your idea is called counseling. So people pay a lot of money for that kind of thing. So
right, maybe
actually maybe there's a business idea.
I was gonna say maybe we should do like agency therapy or something like that.
maybe. Right, fantastic. So we'll call it a day there because, like Marcus said, we could go on forever, but we will leave it there. So if you're enjoying the shows, we'd really appreciate it if you could head along to iTunes and leave us a review there. You know, they help us get a bit more visibility in iTunes. And as always, if you have any ideas or suggestions for things you'd like us to talk about, just drop us a line at podcast@thecreativebusinesspodcast.com, and we will definitely get back to you. Thank you so much, Marcus, once again.
Absolutely. Thank you. And we'll be back next week.
We will be back next week with more heart to heart.
That's right.
See how depressed, we can get next week.
There you go. We'll talk about something cheerier. Take care.
Cheers, Marcus. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.